Hello, Internet. This is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, which is live streamed most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT. We're broadcasting at davidrovics.com/quarantine on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio, as well as via my channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. You can find all of these discussions archived on my YouTube channel in the Discussions with David playlist and in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform or go to davidrovics.com. If you have any suggestions for future guests on my show or if you are involved in some way with a social media account that might be a good place from which to live stream my discussions, I'm very interested in guest suggestions and I have the capacity to add additional platforms to the broadcast. Today's guest has been actively involved with movements for the radical transformation of the failed states of America for his entire adult life. Raised by survivors of the Nazi Holocaust, Peter grew up not far from where my own parents grew up in New York City. His troubles with the law began soon thereafter, and in the early 1970s, he was arrested by police, followed by the FBI, shot at, and imprisoned for his anti-war activities in San Diego. He went back to college in the 80s and wrote his PhD dissertation at the University of Massachusetts on the political economy of racism. His long career as a professor of political economy at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, began soon thereafter. Peter is fluent in both Spanish and English and has traveled extensively in many parts of the world, including throughout Latin America, where he has also been deeply involved with various social movements over many years. I believe it's fair to say that most of the countries Peter has traveled in have been attacked by the U.S. military and/or have been the victim of economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. Congress. Peter, Professor, welcome to my live stream show.
Thank you, David. Thanks for the very nice introduction.
I just want to start out by asking what may normally be kind of a boring question to ask guests, but these days is, I think, particularly relevant in spite of the fact that there's a whole lot going on all over the rest of the world. I want to start with how's things been for you over the past couple months and how have been the adapting to teaching online and quarantine and everything else local?
So, yeah, I feel altogether compared to most people in the world, my life is so much easier. I have a house, I have a full-time job, which I do enjoy doing, even online. So every once in a while, when I feel a little bit sorry for myself by not being able to travel, not being able to hug people so much, I get a little down. I think, you know, stop feeling sorry for yourself. Look what's going on in Brazil, New York, you know, right throughout the United States in prisons and detention centers. I've been doing some work with solidarity with prisoners. Over the last few years, basically through the Black Prisoners Caucus, I've been doing these like 1 or 2 day workshops, often with other people on the political economy of the US, strategies for radical change and so on. Even though increasingly I'm having problem getting in, or even my letters getting in, they've really cracked down in the present period, but I'm still corresponding either directly or indirectly with a lot of prisoners. And not surprisingly, the coronavirus is being used as a way to further discipline people. Like people in one prison I'm in contact with at Stafford Creek near Olympian Arbor, and yeah, three people, African-Americans, took off their masks because they were having trouble breathing. Actually, one did originally, thrown to the floor by the guards, maced, put in solitary. And even the 6 foot distance, which is really hard in a prison, it's being used against people to discipline them, losing privileges, for example, for the commissary, which is very important because a lot of the food, people don't feel very safe eating. So I've been doing some of that. I've gone to a few demonstrations. Olympia has been somewhat of a target, like one I went to on May Day that I also worked on. It was called a demonstration for essential excluded workers, and it was continuing the tradition of May Day. And we had a car caravan coming from both Whatcom County and Skagit, northern Washington and Seattle. We all met in Olympia, and we caravaned. There were probably 50 to 100 kind of right-wing counter-protesters there, also a few of them armed. So it's somewhat of a tense situation. The police seemed much more hostile to us than they did to the basic Trump people. There were a lot of MAGA stuff, a few AK-47s. But I thought it was kind of successful, and we did slow down some of the area around the governor's office. There's always one about freeing prisoners I went to also. So it's been a little bit hard that way. I'm teaching online through Zoom with a very good teacher named Sabina Chowdhury, and we're teaching a class called Political Economy in the Time of the Coronavirus. Seems kind of appropriate at this time.
We somehow just
decided the last minute to do it. And at first, the whole thing of, again, teaching online, I'm very much into personal contact. I think that's my best part of teaching, more than the material of talking to people, treating people with respect, which has always been a very big part of my life, and trying to learn from students as well as teach. So first, really dreading it, but now we're coming toward the end of the quarter, spring quarter, and a lot of the students are saying, including me, that we enjoy just getting together. It's better than the total isolation. So that's a little bit what I've been doing enough to.
Yeah, it is. It is something. I mean, actually having these conversations on Zoom and being able to teach through Zoom, it is. You could see why people would dread it at first, but it is still communication. Actually, yeah, especially when people can hear what you're saying, which has gotten better. It seems over the past few weeks for a lot of people.
Yeah, and there was still a lot of technical problems. I think a lot of problems with Zoom. It was being used so increased in use. We haven't had problem with like right-wing people coming in, but I know that's been a problem with some friends of mine in other parts of the country.
And it seems like at this point, of course, there's so many fault lines being exposed by the pandemic and the lockdown and the various other aspects of the response in the United States and around the world. But like, I was just before interviewing you, I was reading up on your bio a bit, as I've done in the past for other projects, but I didn't even remember that your PhD dissertation was on the political economy of racism, which seems like about the most relevant topic to be discussing right about now, both in terms of the incredibly unequal death rate between different racial groups in the United States, but also in terms of all these police killings that have been going on.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Partly what I did the dissertation that going back to the 60s when I started getting active, I always took it as a given that challenging racism and white supremacy was really central to any possibility of change in the United States. So not only morally correct, but also strategically right. And so that's what I did my dissertation on. It wasn't economics. And a very common view in like mainstream economics is that the market will overcome racial differences. And that just seems so different from what was going on in the United States. So what I tried to do, it took me a long time, 400 pages, because the whole academic style is arguing that it really was the social movements, particularly the Black Liberation Movement and the basic Black Freedom Movement and Civil Rights Movement, those movements that they led to really major improvements in racial equality in the 60s and 70s, mainly in terms of income and class. But with the decline of those movements, you had stop, you didn't have increased improvement. And the way I did it, I showed that most of the gains, I went to 85, most of the gains were in the public sector, which opened up, and it was the Kerner Commission that was in the 60s, that was by Lyndon Johnson, set up by the governor of Illinois, that asked for hiring 1 million more African Americans in the government. And you really had opening up, not equal, but opening up at state, local, and federal government. That's where the improvements were, much less in the private sector. And certainly, and let's get today, the three, I mean, so much going on, like even the incredible disparities in who's dying in nursing homes between Blacks and whites being the biggest difference. Yeah, but the recent killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. It really affected me. I have four kids. I know, you know, most of them, Dave, like Josina, my daughter, who lived in Minneapolis many years, she had many mutual friends with George Floyd. She didn't know him specifically. And she was saying people who are friends and acquaintances of her for the first time in their lives have gone to some of these actions after his death. And yeah, he worked at a club that said the only Latino club basically in Minneapolis, at least when she was there. And he was a security guard there. And that was a club she almost went to. She always went to. And her partner also worked in security at that place who died, but who she sure knew him. Just saying he's a really incredibly kind and good guy. She had a kind of a gentle giant was the way she described him. And probably more that will come out. But yeah, that one really affected me, together with the kind of lynching of Ahmaud Arbery, the killing in her own house of Breonna Taylor, and so much more that anybody, who says a kind of racism thing of the past, it's crazy. And I don't know how much I think of this. So I've also been to Brazil in terms of places I've been to that suffered a coup in 1964 because they had kind of a neutral reformist president who was not acceptable to the powers that be in the U.S. But it's, the killings by police have really increased. They were super high before. Officially, there were 1,800 killed in Rio de Janeiro last year by the police, 1,800 people. And really, I think, aided and abetted by Bolsonaro saying, he supported that. And with Trump, I mean, obviously, we had so many police killings before, so I would never say he's the cause of it. But his encouragement of the police, kind of the whole police state stuff, certainly is a factor. And one of my sons was telling me, I haven't seen it, that the cop who just unbelievable, the killing of Floyd, had at a Trump rally, had worn a hat saying, "Make America White Again."
This cop did. That's very open. They say openly. I mean, they're not usually quite so open about their white supremacy or fascist tendencies. Although, I mean, we know one of the really fascinating things I think about the police in Greece is how they vote according to where they work. And so we know for a fact that 50% of the police in Greece are actually fascists. Right. Even though 7% of people vote for the fascists, I think in the year that was taken, but it is a profession that tends to attract fascists, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Peter, I one of the things I think that's especially interesting and horrifying and fascinating, and every other on the whole spectrum of emotional or whatever other kind of responses, is the stark differences between how the pandemic has affected the U.S. and the response to the U.S. To the pandemic here in the U.S. compared to many other countries where things have gone much better, including countries that have been dealing with U.S. sanctions for decades, like Cuba. And I don't know if you've been hearing much in terms of how things are going in Venezuela or in, I think, Vietnam, another example. But I wonder if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yes. So with regards to Cuba and Vietnam, Cuba having a few contacts, plus reading the statistics every day, I'm kind of a numbers person, and I look at the numbers every day, and really low amount of cases. And having one policy, and I do believe that particularly with regards to health in Cuba, especially in Vietnam to a lesser extent, that the government has legitimacy, certainly in terms of health care. So people are listening to what's being said, and it does seem really, positive. I've been to Cuba four times. I lived there once with my kids, and I taught at the University of Havana, the largest school in Cuba. And Cuba to me certainly is not this, model of socialism that I believe in, but in terms of basic things like dignity of people, which seems pretty important, that's really encouraged by the government, encouraging Cuban culture, but also very internationalist at the same time. And the health system to me is really impressive. I remember the time I lived in Cuba, sometimes that can be a klutz. And the very first day I tried to turn on a gas stove and I had to heat the house. And I kept trying it, and it finally exploded. I lost all my eyelashes. I couldn't see. So I went to a clinic, and, you know, then they, I don't know, gave me some drops and stuff. I got better in a few days. And I said, oh, can I give you a little bit of money? And they said, don't insult us. Mm. And just, to, you know, every few blocks, there were these clinics. And it's still very, very impressive. You know, Cuba's a pretty poor country. But it really has a healthcare system with infant mortality lower than the United States, which is pretty amazing, right?
Yeah.
And a
life longevity. Yeah.
Exactly. Life expectancy, about 79 years, I believe. Very, very similar to the U.S. And so that isn't surprising. Cuba. Vietnam, I've taken classes to Cuba. I've also taken classes to Venezuela because I'm always looking for alternatives to U.S. capitalism and capitalism in general. Yeah. So I took classes for 2 months and I stayed longer in 2009 and 12 to Venezuela. And I had so much hope for it. Again, you know, that even though Chavez had a lot of power, it seemed he also really was pushing for people developing power at the base level, what are called communal councils and communes. And you had a really developing health system. It was somewhat dependent on Cubans, right? They had these clinics, and it was mainly Cuban doctors, because basically in the poor neighborhoods, Venezuelan doctors weren't interested. But they were also teaching Venezuelans to be doctors. And there were really improvements in healthcare. And there's still a lot of Cuban doctors there, but there's been a lot of decline in Venezuela since. Really serious problems that certainly we can understand outside the U.S. attempt to sanctions, the attempt to overthrow it. But I think a lot of internal errors, corruption, lack of democratic rights, maybe more repression that's necessary, really major economic mismatch, particularly with the currency. So I'm not sure about the healthcare there. The figures do look better. And again, even recently, I don't know if you saw this, just again, just incredibly, reprehensible. The U.S. supported coup, I don't know how much, attempted a coup with kind of led by U.S. mercenaries of Venezuela. So
a spectacularly failed effort that seemed to have no idea. They had no idea about that this was a government that actually had a base of support. I mean, it was like the same kind of, what was so surprising about it was the repetitiveness of these kinds of historical events, how like it was so reminiscent of the Bay of Pigs, except not as well organized, but right. Just as much of a spectacular fail or much more of a spectacular failure, really.
Yeah, I think with the Bay of Pigs, there really was so much U.S. support organization of the coup, huge amount of resources for it. It really was a U.S. coup. The thing with Cuba, with using Cuban basically mercenaries, people who had been part of the Batista government, the dictatorship before. In Venezuela, it seems the U.S. clearly knew about it. They clearly didn't try to stop it or do anything about it. I'm not sure how much aid there was. It was so bungled. I don't think the CIA is all that competent, but it's hard to believe that the U.S. wasn't involved in a really major way in it. But I think the training was both in Colombia and the U.S., so certainly there was a U.S. role in it.
Yeah.
Which is unconscionable.
Right. Unconscionable. But I just also wonder about like the state of mind of so many of the people in the U.S. administration currently who, I mean, just seem to be so completely out of touch with actual reality in so many ways. I mean, not that that's unusual or new, but the level of sort of living in a fantasy world with the Trump administration seems to be at a whole different kind of scale, would you say?
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, I mean, we look at some of these U.S. presidents, and I mean, some of the Democrats are bad enough, but we consider, like, I guess thinking over the last 50 years, Nixon, Reagan, who, again, you know, the kind of crimes he committed in Central America, you know, we can talk about that if you want. Both Bushes, you know, George H.W. Bush gets a pass, but, you know, he was, you know, a total killer in, you know, as head of the CIA, I think very involved in a lot of the Iran-Contra stuff, so much other stuff, too.
The George bombing Bush. Of Iraq, the invasion, the invasion of Panama, and
Right. Exactly. Yeah, because I sometimes get upset when people, you know, think that he's really not so bad. Maybe he's better than his son, but then, you know, his son, George Bush, kind of out of touch with reality, too. You remember the whole 9/11 stuff, right?
Right. Although, in comparison, he was like a team player who listened to his advisors, which seems like, I mean, even though his advisors were a bunch of Goldman Sachs and Pentagon people, it was still sort of a team of evil people rather than whatever is going on now, which doesn't seem like so much of a team as much as like a megalomaniac with a bunch of yes men, which, you know, it's kind of a different level of activity.
I agree with you. And, you know, and sometimes I think, is it just presentism? But I really feel the same way that you said, that it really is on a whole different level. Maybe not on the policies, but I am very worried about this growth of fascism, authoritarianism here. I often feel people on the left have cried wolf. I remember once when Nixon was president, I bet some friends of mine said fascism is here. And they were, you know, I suffered a lot under Nixon. We can get into it if you want. But yes. I remember betting a friend of mine who would, he had been in the military and he left, and there were a lot of people supported him. It was a very common thing in the 60s and 70s where he took sanctuary and people supported him until the military police came. He got out, was really active, but then said fascism is here with Nixon. I remember betting him $25, which is like $100 today, that he could distribute leaflets in 5 years. And he said, you definitely wouldn't be able to. So even though Nixon, it was so, the whole Watergate stuff, so much attacks on the COINTELPRO, which you mentioned briefly. But I do feel now that kind of support for Trump by a significant part of the population, nowhere near majority, and that's really important to remember, no matter what he does, is really, really worrisome. And then when you add to that, you know, we talked about the unreality a little with Venezuela, the thing Guaido, the guy, you know, the U.S. puppet, that he could just easily take over. And fortunately, they've been wrong. But the pandemic, to me, the coronavirus, really brings it home of just what he says is the truth, what Fox News says, that's the truth. And it is really, really worrisome.
Because the numbers actually are kind of exposing the reality, isn't it true? I mean, the collapse of healthcare sectors and what's going on in Manaus and Brazil, like with the total collapse of the healthcare system, it's evident that you can deny reality, but then there's this pandemic and it's spreading exponentially when it's not being controlled, and that's kind of impossible to just deny with a fantasy.
Definitely. Saying it's like a cold or flu, the light flu doesn't make it so, which Bolsonaro, Trump's twin, you know, has been saying a lot.
With the election of Trump's twin, I mean, Bolsonaro, would you say that the corruption of the previous administration had much to do with the election of Bolsonaro?
Yeah, I was in Brazil in 18. I gave some talks there. It was before the election there. And there was a whole tendency, you know, in Latin America, people call it the pink tide, progressive governments coming to power through electoral ways. You know, Argentina, Chile, Bolivia, Ecuador, Brazil. I would include Venezuela in that, but Venezuela being the most socialist-oriented of those two, very, very dependent on rising prices of commodity prices. And Brazil had this boom. And Lula, who I had a lot of hope for, who had been a very impressive labor leader, and the Workers' Party that he played a major role in starting was very much connected to the social movements. But over time, wanted to kind of compromise with capital, even though there were a lot of improvements. You had the prices falling of some of the basic commodities. And then after his terms, Dilma Rousseff was the next president, ex-guerrilla fighter against a military dictatorship there. But I think followed more austerity policies too, when they began to have economic problems and losing some support. I mean, corruption is so intrinsic in Brazil, and I think the Workers' Party altogether is maybe less corrupt than some of the others, but certainly there was a lot of problem of buying people's seats. This company called Odebrecht, this huge construction company, basically buying governments for construction contracts all over Latin America, including Mexico. And so I think the corruption contributed, increasing alienation. I don't know the voting turnout, but I think a lot of poorer people who had supported the Workers' Party so much, they still voted overwhelmingly for, the mayor of Sao Paulo who ran against Lula was imprisoned, at the time, I think on false charges. So I think weariness, thinking, again, Bolsonaro campaigning as a real alternative. And racism is very, very big in Brazil also. It calls itself a racial democracy, but it seems there's a lot of commonality in the United States, with even a larger Black African population there too. His support has decreased some. And again, the agribusiness was really important in his victory. There's a growing evangelical movement, and the leaders of it very much supported Bolsonaro. Kind of like with Trump here, that they don't care about his personal life in either case, but voting for somebody because the anti-abortion, anti-LGBT is really major. The whole view that had some appeal, not just evangelicals, of indigenous people having special rights, kind of like the reverse racism here. All those are factors. His support Bolsonaro has declined some, but it is really troubling. I think he still has some real support too, and there is that authoritarianism that does exist in most countries in the world, and Brazil is one of them.
It seems like, ever since the rise of Trump in particular, it's like, as you say, of course, when there's from my own personal experience, whenever there's a Republican in power, there are elements of the left who are saying, we're going to have fascism any minute now. And anytime there's a Democrat in power, there are sort of grassroots right-wing elements who are afraid of exactly the same kind of thing, in the form of what they call global government or whatever, they're afraid of. But everybody seems to be afraid of being rounded up and sent to internment camps, by the new government, whatever it might be. But in the particular case that we're in right now with Trump, being a fan of history and having read, fairly a lot about the rise of fascism in Europe in the 30s, it seems like the number of parallels are really kind of astonishing. Like, maybe not astonishing, but there are more than a few parallels in terms of like how Trump is behaving in terms of firing everybody that he doesn't like and the questioning the relevance of elections and that just all these acting heads of departments that aren't vetted by Congress as weak as a thing as that phenomenon is, and especially the decades of austerity budgets led by Democratic administrations in this country that have so deeply impoverished so many people, which also reminds me of the sort of inability of social democrats in Germany to really rule in the kind of way that might have avoided with all the obstacles that they had from corporations, from the military and all this, of course, not to blame social democrats for everything that happened by any means, but if they had been able to do a better job of running the country, potentially they could have avoided the rise of fascism. And it seems to me if housing hadn't doubled in cost under the 8 years of Obama's administration, not to say that Obama was entirely responsible for that by any means, but that's kind of what happened. And that's what a lot of people think of during his time in the White House is the cost of rent doubled during that time for so many people and many other problems that, things, the stratification of wealth got worse. And I wonder what do you think about these parallels? It's made too often, but.
No, I do think there are some. So the austerity is an important argument that kind of the weakness of a lot of these austerity programs for people's lives. And I try to say that was a factor in Brazil, too, in the victory of Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro is much more openly fascist in the rhetoric, right? In the sense of continually praising the military dictatorship, saying they should have killed more communists. And I don't know if you remember, there was an attempt that seemed really so false and a kind of a right-wing attack when Rousseff, who followed Lula, she was being impeached for supposedly transferring money from one part of the budget to another, nothing to do with personal corruption. And Bolsonaro was a deputy, and he brought pictures and praised the person who had been the torturer of her to the hearing. I mean, just really sick.
Really?
And Trump is not as open that way. You know, just I'll mention one more person. So another person who I think is very dangerous in terms of fascism, I'm calling this growth this authoritarian international. And I think another key person is Modi in India.
Yes. Yes. Right. Very, very.
Really, you know, again, and you know, obviously the scapegoat, that's, you know, I mean, that's the obvious one, Germany also. And so, you know, with Modi, it's the, you know, the Muslim population. And he is a leader in a group called the RSS.
Yeah.
Which, you know, isn't as much known as the BJP. That's the party he's the head of. But the RSS, to me, is an openly fascist organization. You know, it goes, it worshipped Mussolini in the 30s. And it's really into this Aryan, but, you know, they mean basically Hindu nationalism. And they have a large military force and a very organized group. And Bolsonaro,
it's sort of the military wing of the Hindu Nationalist Party, is it? Or the precursor of it or something? Wasn't it banned at some point?
I think it's both the precursor. They claim to be totally separate, even though Modi's part of both. I'm not sure if he says he's still a member. He certainly has been a leader of it before. And from friends of mine, they're saying he's still very much part of it. Right. So I'd say what you said is right in reality, not in, they would say no. So in the United States, even though, you know, these paramilitary groups, even, you know, these demonstrations, like I mentioned, there was one when we had our May Day protest here, they're relatively small. So I don't see the kind of organization like the Nazis had in Germany. I mean, my fear is sometimes that it could really grow. Mm. And again, we talk about Trump being a continuum, but also different, that his support somewhat ties to this really, let's say, the armed fascist right, I think is different even from, let's say, Bush or Reagan or Nixon. I mean, Nixon was a lot of tied to the kind of right-wing Cubans. I guess that would be, you know, the fascist Cubans of there were various groups in the United States at the time. And definitely, you know, the Watergate people came out of that. And the CIA was always connected to those groups. But here, I think there are more connections. And that is, it could be a base that could grow. I mean, I've sometimes worried, is Trump going to allow, you know, if he loses the election, which I do believe it's important he does. So that's the analogy I made. I mean, I can't think of one good thing about Biden. I'm sure maybe we spent a week, we could maybe think of one thing. I remember that's once when I asked Eisenhower, it's an aside, I remember I was like 15, about he supported Nixon as his vice president for president against Kennedy. And he said, if you give me a week, maybe I could think of one thing. Hardly much of an endorsement.
Yeah, right.
That's great. So I know. So I guess with Biden too, but I do think this growth of authoritarianism, you know, you mentioned the fascist parts, the attacks on the media, the kind of really major attempt to totally redo the judiciary is really, really worrisome. Even though we're hardly fans of the mainstream media.
Yeah, that's the same at the same time, right? You know, it's like sometimes he says stuff that's that just is so accurate, which is one of the disarming kind of things about about people like him, is that he's not pretending. Sometimes he's oftentimes he's pretending to be one thing or the other, but sometimes he's just says some straightforward thing, like in that interview when he was running for president, and he said, "Well, we got a lot of blood on our hands too," like referring to U.S. foreign policy, which is like you just don't hear anybody saying that, you know.
Exactly.
And I just on NPR just 2 days ago, I heard them once again. I mean, I almost can't believe my ears when I hear them say this. It was the headline, and they said, "More people have died from the coronavirus than died in the Korean and Vietnam wars put together." More people. It's just astounding that they can't still say that kind of thing, not differentiating between American troops and civilians from Korea and Vietnam, who of course died in their millions.
So no, I it was kind of emotional for me in the class, moving toward the end of the quarter, and it's the political economy, the time of the coronavirus. So we're moving to talk about social movements, alternatives to capitalism, which has been a very big part of my life. Kind of find places, think of them theoretically, and so on. Because I think it's really important to criticize what's going on, but that's important analysis of capitalism, including the global capitalist system we live in. Like we were talking about connections to how the coronavirus, its impact on who and why in our healthcare system. But I think often the left doesn't spend enough time about where we want to go and strategy. So that's what we're moving to in our class, and so on. Tuesday, I did kind of the Vietnam War, the anti-war movement that I was very involved in, both the war and, you know, people knew very little about, even though these are all, you know, it's evergreen, probably because Sabine and I teach in the class, probably the most conservative students in the class are big Sanders supporters. So it's not, it's kind of, you know, a very kind of really nice group of people. But people knew almost nothing about the Vietnam War, right? Because, you know, let's say the oldest students in this class is a young class, maybe early mid-30s. Mm-hmm. So think, you know.
Yeah.
But just showing the war, and I showed a movie. I think maybe David was a great student in my class many years ago. I think it was 1993, if I remember. I'm not
That's
sure.
That's right. That. And you That's showed right. Hearts and Minds.
Oh, exactly.
It's such a fantastic movie.
And it just, you know, I've seen it probably 20 times. And even talking about, you know, the movie, we had people watch the movie outside of class, and we had a two-hour class about both the anti-war movement lessons from it, but also about the war itself. And one book I looked at, it's called Kill Anything That Moves. Kill Anything That Moves. And the estimates are at least 2 million people were killed in Vietnam. That doesn't include Indochina, Laos, and Cambodia. And I remember in the movie, you know, Daniel Ellsberg said, because a very common view was the United States was on the wrong side. It should have supported the NLF, Ho Chi Minh, the North Vietnamese. He said, that's wrong. He said, we were the wrong side. Not just we were on the wrong side, we were the wrong side. And therefore, if you take that, you know, everybody who's killed, basically the United States plays a role. But yeah, so the 55,000, yeah, that really, you know, bothers me a lot too. And it still goes on. And, you know, one lesson I said from that, it's hard because the movements have to learn, just like the people in power learn a lot. And one thing they learned from Vietnam was that if you can minimize U.S. casualties, you know, and this is Cheney and Rumsfeld, you know, who really were they were the leaders under Bush. And we talked about Bush, but he was like the puppet kind of too. And, you know, mechanized in war, the whole drones, which, you know, Obama used incredibly much also with his meetings where they decide who to kill, right, with the drones too, is we can minimize U.S. casualties. That's a way to limit, you know, opposition here. Many other reasons too. And so, you know, one point, again, the anti-Vietnam War movement, at least one big part of it was always focusing on bring the troops home. Of course, then they can use more bombing, which they did, the Vietnamization, or just talking about 10,000 deaths, 20,000 deaths. It seems that we have a responsibility that all human lives have the same value of dignity. That's really what's motivated me a lot, I think, my whole life since I got particularly conscious. And so having to focus on all lives and not just dying by bombs, you know, poverty that could prevent it is also violence. So really focus on a kind of a global perspective. And that, of course, leads to not talking about, you know, more death from the coronavirus than from Vietnam and Korea.
Yeah. But also in terms of like what you're talking about, the visions of the future for the left. You know, a few months ago, many people might have been having very different discussions than they're having now. Like all of a sudden, there's a lot of things on the table that are being talked about in a much more widespread way in many throughout this society, I think, and I'm sure in many other societies about what is what are important, what's important, what's the role of government, should you know, what is the how should we cancel rents, suspend mortgages, all this kind of stuff, and this massive bailout package. I mean, it's I know that I'm not asking a question here, I'm just talking about way too many things at once, but I mean, you know, when I think about like after the Depression, when the stock market crashed in 29, it took like, wasn't it like 3 years before really the massive government spending kicked in, and the kinds of reforms that Roosevelt is known for that were not enacted immediately by any means, right? And what has happened recently with this bailout, which has to some extent included bailing out regular people, it's been really quite something. And I wonder what did you expect that this kind of thing could even be done by the U.S. government, that there was enough sort of leadership capacity in the Congress to even do something like this? Or what do you think of this?
Okay. Well, let me say first, I know you've been very supportive of these rent strikes also, probably for both personal and political reasons, that you've been right about the whole rent strike stuff.
Yeah.
And I just want to mention, in Olympia, you know, she's got a lot of target, a woman named Bernarda Rollins, who's a city council person, and really different from most city council people. Most of the city council in Olympia, maybe like Portland, they're very liberal about issues that don't deal with issues of class and poverty. You know,
yeah, like, as long as it's about social issues, which I've just to interrupt for a moment, at going around postering about the rent strike, it's very interesting to note which posters get taken down and which don't, and where. Because, you know, as it happens in this city, you can post anything around social issues and nobody cares, or maybe they like it. But, you know, if you post anything having to do with not paying the rent, you know, anywhere near a major apartment complex, watch how fast those posters come down.
Definitely. And I always argue Olympia, very similar to the city council, it really represents the homeowners, which is important, but that's a little bit less than half the population of Olympia.
Right.
But anyway, Renata, you know, she's both supportive of the rent strikes and personally said she's not paying rent and wrote a manifesto on that. It might be a personal interview. Yeah.
Yes.
For example, the Olympian last Sunday, the whole editorial was that if she cared about people not paying the rent, because she said she had enough money to pay. She's not a wealthy person at all. She works for a radio station in Olympia. But that she would use her money to help people. That's how she could help. But I know with me, there've been so many letters to the editor, or like the opinions, you know, saying Peter's a hypocrite. You know, he works at Evergreen and he always is talking about homeless solidarity. Why doesn't he take more people into his house? As if that's the solution.
As if you could solve the homeless problem in your two bedroom house or whatever.
Right.
Come on.
So anyway, but that's the same Bernard who lives in the, you know, give him the money. But anyway, I do think something significant is happening. And you're right, with the we've done some classes comparing the Depression and response to the current situation too. There's a really good presentation by some students yesterday about that. And both the movements and the government response took a few years.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So for example, the minimum wage, the legitimation of unions, the Wagner Act, all of those were like mid to late 30s, after there'd been a lot of movements too. And usually in economics, a very common view is when unemployment gets worse, then movements decline because people are more afraid of losing their job even more. And maybe that happens for a while, but it seems after a while, people do resist. They feel there's no alternative to doing it. And some of the issues that are being raised now are really important. Let me just mention a few in terms of thinking about alternatives. Mm. So I've for a long time supported the idea of a universal basic income, not a universal basic income like a neoliberal version, you know, the kind of way that some of the kind of Silicon Valley people have proposed, or Andrew Yang, who ran for president, of basically replacing social programs. I see a universal basic income that would be in addition to healthcare for all, childcare, free education, housing, more public housing, affordable housing. But then that would be, people would have enough to live and not rich, but would be in a better bargaining position. You could argue then, you know, for your employee, if they don't pay you well, you're just not going to do the job. It would increase workers' bargaining power. And I remember once giving a talk to a group of artists, a mixed collective in Olympia, and all of them were saying, and you probably talk about it much better than I could, none of them could support themselves on what they did as poets, musicians. So they all had jobs they hated, except maybe one person, that if there was a universal basic income, they maybe wouldn't work unless they had, you know, a job like in kind of doing art. So that seems great to me. Mm-hmm. And this idea is resonating because of the coronavirus, seeing that people do need to live. And the $1,200 is, it's nothing. I shouldn't say nothing. I mean, it's something, but if it goes over a few months, it's basically doesn't really help.
If it were every month, it would be something.
Something. And yeah, and I, when I made some calculations on a universal basic income, I had something like, $1,200, this was a while ago, so maybe $1,500 now, $1,200 a month for adults, and then maybe $600 for people under 18, and 18 and up, you get $1,200. And it would be a sizable chunk of money. But for example, one of the things that's shown that you can actually run government deficits, and people, it doesn't cause necessarily inflation, doesn't cause interest rates to go up. In economics, there's a whole view called modern monetary theory that's kind of connected to. And I think the theory is not as novel as people claim that it is. But I think in a situation with a lot of unused resources, unemployed people, running government deficits doesn't cause inflation or somehow collapse of the economy. So this idea of a universal basic income, which it makes labor a bit less of a commodity, so I like that. And of course, when I did the math on it, I also raised taxes significantly. But if people making over $100,000 a year, that would recapture most of that money. So that idea comes up. Also, to me, I really like in terms of strategy idea of decommodifying, that basic needs being met, not, you know, for who can pay for them, but just because we're human beings and needs, and the idea of healthcare for all. Either something like the Sanders plan or John Conyers going back of single pay, where you just had the government pay the provider. And I like in the latest proposal includes undocumented workers, undocumented immigrants, too, which seems so important. A lot of the earlier bills didn't do that. That idea has resonance. And I think many people understanding that even if you're not sick, that everybody being covered, that also protection of you. You know, economics, that's called externalities. Mm. And similarly, with realizing that if people have no other source of income, even sick, they have to go to work, which may affect you too. I mean, I would hope people just have solidarity, but I'm saying even in terms of self-interest, some of these issues of healthcare for all, public transit, the rent, the housing is a basic right. You know, I call it housing justice. Some of these ideas, which make, they're not socialism, but to me, they're really kind of, I call them non-reforms, reforms, which has been a big idea of mine for many years. It comes from a French philosopher called André Gortz, G-O-R-Z, in a book called Strategy for Labor, working on reforms that meet people's needs, but can fully be met within the current society and builds people's consciousness and organization so they demand more. And some of these ideas like, yeah, the rent strikes, the universal basic income, the Medicare for all, education for all, also like this really this major crisis at Evergreen and other colleges too about tuition, revenues, and so on. So some of these ideas now are, I think, resonating. They're really, we don't have the organization yet. And certainly what the Democratic Party decided to do says that they're not going to be very easy to attain. But it does seem something is going on in an exciting way. And again, maybe the 30s is an analogy there, which is probably, maybe the 60s too, where ideas of socialism, anti-capitalism really resonated beyond a few people. And that is happening now. There's maybe more defeatism and pessimism compared to the late 60s. Mm. But in terms of ideas of pro-socialist, anti-capitalist, I would argue it's at least as strong as it was 50 years ago.
And when ideas are resonating, that can be in itself a powerful force, yeah?
I think so. I think it's, I think we both the ideas, I think the ideas are so important. We need both the organization and the ideas, but I think they both can build on each other. And so that to me, again, it's not sufficient, but I see as really important. And connect to that, when Bernie Sanders ran in 16, it took me a while to support him. I remember I wouldn't do it publicly, a lot because of the international stuff, including, even though, like you mentioned, I'm the son of Holocaust survivors, my dad was imprisoned by the Nazis, that being of Jewish background, what Israel, the oppression they've done to Palestinians, has always really upset me, and feeling a responsibility particularly to challenge it. And I thought Sanders had been pretty weak around issues of Palestine. But I did advise both the county and Evergreen organizing around the Sanders campaign. But then we used to have caucus in Washington. Remember the caucus, I did speak for him. And to me, the Sanders campaign has been really significant. Again, I wouldn't call him a radical or a socialist, even though he uses the word socialist. I would call him a social democrat in the way that I know, David, a lot of countries you've been to, like Scandinavia, and where there are a lot of public services, progressive taxes, but still basically a capitalist system.
But really much better than here. I mean, really so much measurably, qualitatively, so much better. In terms of the life for the average person, I mean, whether it's sustainable or not.
Yeah, I think it is. And yeah, so I think what you said is really important. And, I'm around a lot of, very left, and many younger people who I love, anarchists.
Yeah, me too. That's why I always have to tell them, capitalism sucks, but it's not all the same, and you need to know that there's a difference between here and Denmark.
We're so much on the same page that way. I think both are important to remember. It's not enough. There's still a lot of alienation of workers. Environmentally, always swimming upstream is always a danger of capital flight, but still it's so different for people's lives. So that I think was important to support Sanders, but also the growth of, the thing you mentioned about consciousness, the ideas of anti-capitalism, of socialism, even though maybe it's vague exactly what it means to people, that has really grown significantly, and he deserves so much credit for it. And he's also, to me, a person of integrity. He continued on the pushing kind of really basic issues and grew around issues like immigration, justice. Like I mentioned how the latest version of the bill didn't include universal health care for everybody who lives in the United States. It doesn't matter whether they're documented or not. Increasingly critical of Israel. And even in 16, when Hillary Clinton, I don't know if you remember this, tried to red bait him about his support about Nicaragua and Cuba, and he defended his position. That's when I decided to support him then. Mm. And so to me, that's really significant that's been going on. So that's not there. And I tend to be very optimistic. I like the quote from Antonio Gramsci, a really brilliant Italian revolutionary leader. He talks about pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will, right? So I definitely have the optimism of the will. And even though a lot of friends of mine who are right said that there's no way Sanders will get the nomination after some of the primaries, I had some hope. And I didn't think it would become Denmark, but I did think some really important change could happen, particularly if the movements continued, and that he didn't do better, particularly among young people. That was disappointing. And my reflection on it is that there's such still alienation and kind of people so, you know, basically the personal lives in a period where people think there's no future ahead dominates so much of young people. So even though when you ask people, maybe they support Sanders, but the numbers who went to vote were much, much less than I thought they would be. So that,
that Peter, kind of if there is, as I suspect, going to be a militant, large scale social movement to challenge a lot of the inequities in the society, if there is such a movement that develops and is in a large scale way in reaction to so many of the, you know, current situation and so many different aspects of it, can you just give us a couple minutes on some of the obstacles that people are going to face in such a movement? Because I know one thing is that the obstacles are far from direct ones. It's not just police billy clubs and threats of imprisonment, but it's also obstacles that we face much, you know, from our own, in our own circles in many ways, and from underhanded activities carried out by the state as well.
Yeah, so I know, I see we're running out of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, even, again, talking about the 60s, let's say, you know, a group that I worked with some, I think a really important group of the 60s and 70s, the Black Panther Party. We can't understand kind of their decline without the repression, but there's certainly a lot of internal problems, you know, of machismo, and certainly the government tried to play up to it. Maybe not really... that the United States is much farther away from any kind of revolutionary change than people thought. So there's not only the issue of police repression, which I think is really worrisome. And they take new forms now, right, with the much more electronic surveillance. So that's real. I do think we're going to have these movements. So I guess to me, one question is, there's really been a growth of these identity-based movements, you know, LGBT, women's movements, many others that are based on identity. And to me, a question is how to have both unity and diversity, right? There's a danger of saying, you know, we're all just oppressed by capitalism or class is the only issue, but somehow building movements where we can work together with many different types of struggle and also be united. So that seems to me a really, really major challenge that we face right now. And I would say, again, to me, that anti-capitalism is maybe what can unite us. I mean, that's what I hope, with a vision. And, you know, my vision that, you know, just in closing, is some kind of participatory socialist society where basically production is organized around need. People, communities and workers together control society, make decision of what's produced, how it's produced. Well, work would be rotated, but people would really have a lot of leisure time, that we'd focus on social consumption. Like maybe there'd be a library for cars rather than the individual person having cars. But, you know, if you wanted to travel, like go camping, you would have it. Another real challenge is like the global capitalist side we live under, right? Which is really even more than the 60s. We live in a society that's totally, these transnational corporations work globally. And I think there's conscience among this capitalist ruling class all over the world that they see their united interests as workers, as people. We don't see that. So developing, but we see our allies are working people in China, in Brazil, not somebody because they waved the flag on July 4th.
Thank you so much, Peter, on that note, for joining me for this discussion. We're going to have you back to talk about like 500 other things that we didn't mention over the past hour.
So, thank you, Dave. And I just, yeah, I really respect the music you do, the work you do, this show. So keep up the good work. I respect it a lot.
Very, very mutual. Thanks so much, Peter. Talk to you soon.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. And thank you for everybody for joining me for this discussion with Evergreen State College Professor Peter Bomer. Tomorrow we'll be going to Liverpool, England to talk with Nigeria-born playwright, poet, musician, and architect Tayo Aluko. You can tune into my live stream broadcasts every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT. On Mondays, it's an open mic and your participation is wanted. If you have a song or a poem or a rant to share, you can sign up for the next one at davidrovics.com/POMM. That stands for Pandemic Open Mic Mondays. On Tuesdays, the show is Fifth Estate Live, produced by longtime Detroit area talk show host and founder of the Fifth Estate magazine, Peter Werby. Wednesday through Friday, I'm both the host and the producer for Discussions with David. Regardless, it's every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific time, broadcast on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KABU Community Radio, and the Song News Network, as well as my own channels on Facebook, Periscope, YouTube, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. And once again, all of these episodes are archived on the Discussions with David playlist on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovics, as well as in the videos section on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KABU Community Radio, among other places. Each episode is put out in audio podcast form soon after it's been broadcast live, which you can find if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform. We are very much interested in broadcasting on additional platforms, so if you're involved with an organization, a network, or any other group that has a presence on social media that maybe completely lacks any kind of live streaming content, perhaps you want to consider having some of that, which I can potentially provide for you for free. It's a pretty good arrangement, I'd say. Producing and broadcasting this programming every day is not free, either in terms of money or in terms of my time. And if you want to support my live streaming, podcasting, songwriting, and recording efforts, whether there's a global pandemic on or not, but particularly at the moment when we touring musicians are not able to tour, please feel free to send a one-off donation to me at paypal.me/davidrovics or become an ongoing patron at davidrovics.com/subscribe. Or at patreon.com/davidrovics, where all of these episodes can also be found in both video and audio form, along with various exclusive content that's only available for my patrons, such as my 16-part audio memoir. Whether you're in Portland, Oregon or not, if you want to be involved in any way with the rent strike activities here or anywhere else, please check out artistsforrentcontrol.org for some of the popular education resources currently up, and then come back there in a week or so, by which time we should have more concrete ways for folks to connect in mutual aid efforts to stop the evictions before they start. Hope to see you again soon here in cyberspace and who knows where else. Mutual aid and solidarity will get us through. Don't pay the rent.